caused the latest political turmoil. The main issue is that the Israeli coalition cabinet can't really agree on anything. Israeli ministers accuse Israel's prime minister of lying and sidelining his demands, in particular, a proposed budget, the same budget that hasn't been passed. Another election means Israelis have to pay hundreds of millions of dollars for it. Israel's elections are costly. They run upwards of $400 million per election. About 30% of that money, according to Channel 12, will go to party funding. Another 20% will go to party member loans. Israel has had three so far in less than 2 years. According to the Manufacturers Association of Israel, the latest three elections cost Israelis $3.8 billion. This calculation factors in the expense of election days that require businesses to close for the day. In Israel, any election day is a national holiday to facilitate voting. If businesses still open, according to the Israeli law, they need to pay their employees 200% of their normal salary for the day. The Calculation Manufacturers Association of Israel also includes party campaign budgets funded by Israel and the cost of operating the Central Elections Committee, which oversees the electoral process. Furthermore, with caretaker cabinets in place since December 2018, Israel's economic policies have been on hold, while the debt increased and costs continued. Costs incurred by the ongoing political maneuvering and ultimate stalemate that exist following the latest election results may be compounded by yet another election soon. The lack of a budget law has hurt the most vulnerable, worst of all. The lack of a state budget has left working parents, especially lower-income ones, with no immediate solutions to the problem.
You know, it's a lot of money, but I have to be frank with you and the audience. I want to say that this will bring problems and more crisis to the citizens of Israel. But it's not the main crisis in Israel. We can see now this cost of the new campaign and the election will make the crisis wider from one side and deeper from other side. It means that we are already in the crisis. And the election will bring more problems and to make this crisis wider and deeper. You know, everybody, that the election, the fourth one in less than 2 years, is out of the complicated crisis politically, economically, and the health and the corruption crisis in Israel. It's a reflex of this crisis. There is a new phenomena of this fourth election, different than the last three elections. In the last three elections, the main discussion were between the right-wing parties, Netanyahu and the Likud, and from the other side, the center and left forces and parties in, for example, Gantz and the Labour Party and the Meretz and the Common List in the Arab side. But this election is not between these two forces, the right and the, from one side, and the center left in the other side. Now the discussion, the main fight is between the right parties from the other side, other right parties, between the right parties together. And this is a new phenomena wasn't in all the history of Israel from the first election on 1949 till now.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Philippe says, now Israeli elections coming up and have to watch all this over-recharge stuff again. Likud will win again. Benjamin says he's Israeli. The elections are not a big deal. Netanyahu is facing elections also. It's all a ploy. Yona says, Israeli elections are almost officially back for the fourth time in 2 years. Preliminary date of March 16 set. This is the timing Blue and White wanted and not later in the spring post-vaccination that Likud wanted. Though not clear, Blue and White will do any better.
Should be quite clear that the Israeli economy is going to pay and is already paying a very heavy price for having a fourth election in 2 years. But what many people overlook is the moral, psychological, and the motivational damage that is being caused, because there's a large number of people from the Israeli middle class. And it doesn't really matter if it's center-left or center-right, who still believe that Israel is a Western, democratic, Zionist, normal state. And they still believe in the institutions of this state. And what they are discovering, or will discover, is that on top of the pyramid sits a man who will do everything in his ability to remain in power and will subvert the economic and political and justice system of the country. He will undermine it to achieve his goal. At the moment, Israel's debt lies at 14.5% of its GDP. Unemployment is at 20%. Poverty is at 29%. Israelis don't need new elections at this time that will cause $400 million. What they need is good governance, and they need a budget, because there hasn't been a budget for 2020, nor for 2021. Nevertheless, elections are being held, and that is due to Benjamin Netanyahu's insistence on having a one-year budget plan. Netanyahu insisted on having a one-year budget plan, although he agreed to have a two-year budget plan earlier, because he wanted to have absolute control over the situation.
Israelis are upset about this because, according to KAN, the same troublemakers and lawmakers and officials in the Israeli cabinet and Knesset who are calling for a fourth election are the ones who benefit and are in some way rewarded for such political standoffs. And now they're going to get a reward for trying to convince Israelis to pick them again using their own tax money. Many of the members in the Knesset and the cabinet have been there running for their seats since the first election out of three seemingly failed ones. Israelis have lost confidence in them. It seems that no matter how much money is spent on their campaigns and how much fiscal funding they receive courtesy of Israeli taxpayers, they can't even pass a budget that will allow Israelis and Israel in general to function. Israelis believe that this is what the regime wanted. A fourth election looms because it is the only mechanism available to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to call new elections. For Netanyahu, a fourth race in under 2 years would have him not cede his office in November 2021 to his rival-turned-partner, Military Minister Benny Gantz. Netanyahu and Gantz have been circling each other for months. Netanyahu has been seeking to escape the clauses of his coalition agreement. Gantz has been struggling to hold him to it, and the budget has served as the main leverage in that fight. This leaves the Israeli public to be the outcast in all of this, while they bear the biggest brunt. Hence, protesters, which are at their 28th week of protests, Democrats are calling for the downfall of the regime simply because they have had enough.
It means the mass of the citizens of Israel are the main loser. But if we take it in the between parties and the politically, we can see that Gantz and the Labour Party, it means the center and left, who were inside the coalition government, they will be the main loser as the political parties. The second loser will be Netanyahu himself, not the right wing as a political platform, but as the struggle against the corruption of Netanyahu. You know, and everybody knows that he is facing three corruption cases in the court. They didn't reach to this budget because they know that the budget must bring a new hard decisions against the most of the citizens and the businesses out of the situation. They connect that with the political crisis in Israel and with the personal crisis of Netanyahu himself toward the corruption cases which he faced this time. For this reason, the budget issue is a symptom of the deep and wide, multiple and complicated crisis which Israel facing. This complicated crisis in Israel since the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948 wasn't in this thing. But there is some of a part of this crisis were something the same. I want to remember, let's remember together, for example. If we are talking about the political crisis, we saw a political crisis before, like what was in Barak on 1999 in Camp David. And it was a big political crisis in that time that will was in Israel. If we are talking about the economical crisis, we can see two main crises in the history in economics. One, it was in 1985, and the second in 2008.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Classical Lib asks, how many ex-Likudniks have created a new party because Bibi pushed them out? 10 or something like that, right? Noah says, Israel needs a new party, but not with the same old collection of egomaniacs. Michael jokingly says, due to the directives against large gatherings, maybe there should be a directive that no political party can have more than 10 candidates.
Government don't care about the citizens in Israel, and we feel all the corruption in the government taking us down. And Israel is a proud country. We are a proud people who try to save our free and democratic only country in the Middle East. And because of this, the people of Israel is arising against the government.
What took place within the Israeli parliament most recently was that there was a vote to postpone reaching a decision regarding the budget. And while historically and most recently there's been a very strong opposition to Prime Minister Netanyahu from the center and from the left, now there's been a rebellion from the right, and there were members of the ruling Likud party, of all parties, who actually quit and either joined a new party, or people from the right who surprised by voting against the proposition. And that is, this is what is enabling a fourth election. So in fact, there is a growing number of people who believe that they can unseat Netanyahu and remove him, and believe that they could serve as better prime ministers. And it is their personal drive that is causing Israel to go for a fourth election. The reason elections are being held on such a frequent basis in Israel is due to the fact that there isn't a clear consensus. Israeli society is deeply fragmented and divided. Various political parties are pushing in various different directions. Due to the fact that Israel is a so-called democracy, because it's democracy for Jews only, but it's a parliamentary democracy, various parties can pull out when they wish and therefore bring down the coalition once a majority is not secured. And that gives increasing power to smaller political parties. The polarization within Israel is getting stronger and deeper, and elections are therefore being held on a more frequent basis as various parties and figures split, and even within these splits, there are various new splits.
To make matters even worse, in a recent speech, Israeli Military Minister Benny Gantz told Israelis on live national TV that he knew Netanyahu is a serial promise breaker, and that Netanyahu lied to Israelis and did not lie to Benny Gantz, even though he formed a coalition with him. So-called Knesset opposition leader Yair Lapid said citizens shared the feeling that they lost control over their lives. The lack of budget for 2020 has contributed to hardships and cutbacks for Israelis, amid unemployment estimated at over 20%. It seems that as the new year looms, so does another election for Israel. The same parties and the same players are on the table. The only thing new would be the money that would have went to a 2020 budget. Now, it remains to be seen if a budget would ever get passed. This, all the while Israelis suffer. Here is the news making the press in Israel. Ynet News. Israel's malls warn they will not close during new coronavirus restrictions. The operators of Israel's malls said that they would not close their doors again if instructed to do so, as part of tighter measures to reduce the rising coronavirus infection rate. Haaretz. Ministries will be forced to cut their budgets in January by about a quarter of planned levels, a total of 10 billion shekels or $3.1 billion, bringing many regime activities to a standstill, an analysis by the Finance Ministry's Accountant General has found. I-24 News. A survey released shows that more than a quarter of a million Israeli households have fallen below the poverty line since the start of the lockdown responses to the pandemic, an increase of almost 50%. According to the welfare charity Leitet, which also provides meal services throughout Israel, approximately 3 in 10 Israelis, 29.3%, live in poverty, which equates to 850,000 households. That figure represents more than a 9% year-on-year increase, 20.1%. The Jerusalem Post. Some 63% of Israelis plan on being vaccinated against the coronavirus, but only 24% of them plan on getting the vaccine immediately, a new poll published by Ynet News has found. One possible explanation for the relatively low number of Israelis willing to be vaccinated immediately is the public's opinion of the safety of the vaccine. Some 23% of Israelis don't know if the vaccine is safe, 17% think it is not safe, and 6% are sure it is not safe, according to the Ynet poll.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now. If
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islami, dini, wal-Azam ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Today, we're going to be delving into the Islamic laws about the ladies according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, in the last episode, I asked you a rather long question, and you kindly provided an answer in part. Let me ask you this question in another way. And I asked you in the last program that if a woman recognizes herself as being in a state of hayd, yes, all right, certainly there are, things that she can do and she cannot do. All right, yeah. And you mentioned to an experience of yours that you said in Ayatollah Sistani's office you have seen and read many emails from some countries that the women consider themselves, in fact, as not doing anything, basically, not even touching a towel. Or even me, myself, I've seen a documentary. It was very funny that it happened in Africa, and some of the women there, they thought that they didn't even allow their kids to go to school. Like the girls, yeah. Menstruating girls, not to go to school.
Yes.
So they consider this as like an unlawful act, according to the religion. So would you tell our audience and shed more light on the permissibility and impermissibility of some of the obligations she can do?
Let me reiterate by saying that a woman in the state of monthly discharge can touch everything, can cook, can attend religious ceremonies, can even go to a mosque, but provided that she enters from one gate and leaves, exits the mosque from another, and she does not stop there, she does not leave anything there or pick up from the mosque anything, of course. And she can do everything except certain things which are forbidden for her to do. One is prayer, of course. It's a matter of fact. There's no doubt about the fact that a woman who is discharging blood cannot offer prayer. Whether the prayer is mustahab or wajib, whether it is obligatory or recommended, she cannot offer any kind of prayers.
No difference between the, or no dispute between the religious scholars.
Yeah, there's no difference. There's no discrepancy about this among the scholars. Then fasting is forbidden. Mm-hmm. And a woman who discharges monthly blood, her fast becomes white, and she cannot keep near of fasting. Okay,
I see.
If a woman is fasting, okay, it's now, let's say, 5 o'clock in the evening, and there is 1 hour left, and she discharges the period, and she gets her period, all of a sudden, then her fast becomes white, and she cannot keep the niyyah, the intention of fasting. Okay,
mm-hmm.
That is forbidden. So see, she has to eat something, drink something, and of course her fast becomes white, and she cannot keep fasting. Then of course tawaf, I said in the previous episode, a woman in the state of monthly period cannot perform the circumambulation,
mm-hmm.
the tawaf of the house of God. She cannot enter the mosque, Masjid al-Haram, and she cannot perform and rotate the Kaaba unless she is ritually pure. And of course, reading the Quran is permissible, okay?
Yes.
And there's a difference of opinion among religious authorities. Some say, okay, you cannot read the entire chapter, even one letter of the four chapters in which there is an obligatory sajda.
Mm-hmm.
But Ayatollah Sistani says, no, you are not allowed to offer to recite that verse of the Quran which contains sajda.
Only the verse.
And you're not allowed to read even one letter of that verse, okay?
Yes.
So there are four verses, inshallah. In the following episode, I will mention the number of the exact number of those verses.
I appreciate it.
Yes, and then we have also, there is another thing that men and women should observe. Sexual intercourse is strictly forbidden.
Yes.
Forbidden during menstrual discharge. Of course, a man and a woman can drive other places from each other while the woman is menstruating. But vaginal sexual intercourse
mm-hmm.
is absolutely forbidden. And then entering a mosque is forbidden, especially Masjid al-Haram and Masjid al-Nabi. But okay, if a woman wants to enter, and her intention is to enter from one door and leave the mosque from another door, of course there's no problem. But halting, pausing in a mosque, or picking or leaving something in the mosque is not permissible. These are the things that...
But going through the mosque is possible?
Is permissible. Yes, uh-huh. It's permissible. Now, divorcing a woman who is experiencing her monthly discharge, is absolutely forbidden for the husband to divorce her.
Oh.
Okay, the divorce which takes place while the woman is in her menses is invalid. So therefore, the husband should make sure that the woman is that his wife is not discharging blood. It's not that the woman is not in her monthly period. Otherwise, if it transpires that the woman had been in her monthly period while the divorce was conducted, that divorce is invalid. Now, Then touching the script of the Holy Quran, it is forbidden for a woman in the state of hayz or in the state of janaba or in the state of nifas, any of these impurities, to touch the script of the Holy Quran, and also touching the names of Allah, touching the names of the imams and the lady Fatima sallallahu alayha as an obligatory precaution. It is forbidden to touch any of these names, and also touching the attributes of Allah, because there are more than 100 attributes, and those attributes which are of course exclusively used for God, like for example Khaliq, okay, like sustainer, these are the exclusive attributes or names of Allah, and these cannot be touched by a menstruating woman. Of course,
When you say they cannot touch, for example, divine attributes, you mean that they can touch it actually with their hands, like without gloves, for example, right?
Yeah.
Not without something like you can have like some plastic and then.
Yeah, that's permissible. There's no problem, because there's a barrier, something which impedes the direct touch of the skin with the name of God or with something holy. These are some of the things which are forbidden for a woman, but as far as doing things are considered, of course a woman is allowed to do everything except for these things, okay? She can, as I said, and it's very important to insist and repeat it, that a woman in a state of mentally discharged is ritually impure. She's not essentially impure. For example, a dog is essentially impure according to Islamic Sharia. A pig is essentially impure. And it cannot, under any circumstances, a dog cannot be purified. A pig cannot be purified.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Now, I want to conclude by saying that women who are in this state of monthly discharge are ritually impure. Ritually impure means ritual impurity is a kind of accidental impurity.
Yes.
Because the blood is discharged, the woman enters the state of menstruation. The menstruation continues for maximum 10 days. After the 10th day, the woman has to perform ghusl to gain that ritual purity, to attain and obtain the ritual purity. And of course, through performing the ghusl, the ablution, the woman regains that purity. But as far as attending, going to a Husseiniya, attending majalis, cooking nazar, okay, because some ladies in the Indian subcontinent believe that a menstruating woman cannot cook nazar, okay? The food that is distributed among Muslim believers, among the Muslim community. So these are misconceptions and these are misunderstandings on the part of those women, and of course I want them actually, it's very important for them to get acquainted with Islamic teachings, to read the Risala of the religious authorities, no matter which religious authority it is. But actually reading the Risala is by itself very important, because it enriches a person's mind. It helps him or her actually improve her knowledge of the religious laws and religious rulings.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiya and then later they were moved to Najaf and he studied in Najaf. And according to the teachers that we have heard from our teachers or the resources that we had, they have said like he became mujtahid at the age of 16 and he had the ijazah from Ayatollah Khoi.
When we look at his scientific activities, his scholarly books, we see that all of his ideas come from a very established foundation. And that systematic, planned, programmed system can also be observed and manifested in his political and social activities.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher, and I'm Atta, the host of this program. The teacher is mainly concerned with the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, jurists, and philosophers all across the nation of Islam. With me in the studio are two dear experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Dr. Murtazizadeh and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. And Dr. Rezazadeh, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Good to be here.
So, we have started a new series on one of the most outstanding philosophers, thinkers, and jurists of contemporary Iraq. He was really a great Shia scholar, We missed him at the age of 46. He was assassinated and martyred by the Basque regime of Saddam in Iraq. He's no one but Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir Assad, really a mastermind and really a genius regarding Islamic fiqh, usul, philosophy, epistemology, and Islamic economics. Okay, regarding Shahid Muhammad Baqir Assad, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Dr. Reza Zadeh, one of the most outstanding books that he authored is the book Iqtisaduna, Our Economics. This was really a great book regarding Islamic economics. It has been translated into English, and it is one of the magnum opus of Shahid Muhammad Baqir Assad. What is outstanding about this book regarding Islamic economics is the model that was introduced. And according to Shahid Muhammad Baqir Assad himself, what is introduced throughout this book is the a kind of maktab, I mean a school of thought regarding Islamic economics, not the economic science in terms of what we know in today's world, we can say with all these statistics and the numbers and the digits. First of all, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi explained this for us. Why Shahid Baqir Assad considered it as a maktab and not a science, economics, I mean?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Iqtisaduna, our economics, is consisted of two volumes. And in volume one, there are two parts. In the second part, you can find a title as Economy as a Whole or Islamic Economy as a Whole. There's a chapter in it. Basically, in the first volume, when he's talking about the materialism, like the Marxism or the communism and capitalism, after that, it comes to the Islamic economy. And there he's trying to explain the idea that you just mentioned, like as a maktab, why he's saying that. Mm-hmm. He argues there, he says, actually, we cannot say that the Islamic economy is something separate from Islam, from the religion of Islam.
That's right.
And it is the same idea as, you know, we say like the politics is within Islam, economy is within Islam, the social sciences is within Islam. Everything is the part of Islam.
That's right.
There is nothing separate. And that's what he's basically trying to explain over here.
That's right.
He's saying when we talk about, when we say that there is an Islamic economy, it does not mean that it is a science that you will go and learn about it. Mm-hmm. It means that you need to live according to the rulings of Islam.
That's right.
And there, when you're following the rulings of Islam, you're living a life in which you have the Islamic economy.
Okay.
So this economy is not separate. And then he says, like, there are three main things on this. The very first thing is the belief. Mm-hmm. That in Islam, because we believe in God, that's and right. everything has been sent by God, and there is a religion that we believe, the prophet and all those. So we have to have this belief.
That's right.
Second thing is the concepts of Islam. You need to live according to the rulings of Islam, the concepts of Islam.
Very good.
No matter these rulings are in regards to what, you have to live. For example, if Islam says you need to be just, you have to be just in all aspects of your life.
That's right. Okay.
If Islam says you should not, for example, steal anything from anyone, it is in all aspects.
Okay.
Okay. So these are the ideas, the concepts.
So the first
thing is belief. The second thing is concept. The third thing is sentiment. You need to have sentiment towards what you're doing. So when you do this, you can apply this in politics. You can apply this on your prayers. And even he says you can apply this in Islamic economy.
Okay.
Because in Islamic economy, if you want to have an Islamic economy, you must believe in Allah.
That's right.
You must follow the concepts of Islam.
Okay.
Because you're following the concepts of Islam, you are being just.
Okay.
You're not doing. You're not oppressing anyone. That's why when you practice economy, when you're doing like your dealings, it becomes Islamic. That's why he says this is a maktab.
That's right.
It's not a science that you will learn separately.
So can we say that Islamic economics, Ilm al-Iqtisad, is part of the economy that Shahid Saad is introducing in his book?
It is economy of Islam
as a whole.
As a whole.
Okay.
It's a part of Islam because, you know, when we talk about the economy, it's you invest or you buy or you sell or you give loans.
Transactions
that you're doing for the country, obviously, it's different for the country. So he says it's as a whole in Islam. You need to look at Islam as a whole. You cannot separate this thing as a science from Islam.
Okay, thank you very much. Dr. Reza Zadeh, the Hausa is famous for teaching Rasail and Makaseb, okay, which are the famous books.
Fiqh and Usul, yeah.
Yeah, Makaseb, okay, which are somehow related to, these were, both of them were authored by Sheikh Al-Ansari, I think, isn't it?
Yes.
Rasail and Makaseb, isn't it?
Yes. Rasail is Usul, Makaseb is Makaseb Fiqh. Is,
yeah, Fiqh. But in Makaseb, which is Kasb, very much we are close to...
Yeah, financial transactions.
Transactions.
Yeah.
But I think that Iqtisaduna was somehow... we can say a new look at the economy in whole and Islamic economics, with the differentiation that Shaikh Saad made between economics as a science and economics as a maktab or a school of thought.
Yes.
What's your take on that, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, Shaikh Saad himself, in the introduction of the first version of the book, he clearly says that, you know, his idea or his goal for writing that book was to do an in-depth study of the Islamic economy, mm-hmm. and also expressing it or presenting it in a systematic way with a systematic model.
Okay.
And also he wanted to show the foundations and thoughts of the fundamental thoughts of the Islamic economy and clarify the differences of Islamic economy and other economic schools, and also the relationship of Islamic economy with the other parts of Islamic thought. Uh-huh. So he wanted to do all of these things, and the result is this wonderful, amazing book that we see after about 50 years that has passed from authoring of that book. It's still the most important book that has already been authored about Islamic economy.
Okay.
And Iqtisaduna by Shaheed Sadr, because of its comprehensiveness and its deep ideas that he's posing, is still very popular and is being taught in many very prominent universities around the world, including Islamic world, not only the Shia seminaries, but also the Sunni, for example. It is taught in Al-Azhar and in other parts of the world. But for us to have a better understanding of the book, it's also good to have a look at the different chapters or the structure of the book. For example, he talks about, first he starts with an introduction and critique of Marxism.
Mm-hmm.
He also talks about introduction and also critique of capitalism. So he explains these, and this shows that he was aware of the let's say trending economic schools, and then after that he starts talking about the main branches of Islamic economy.
That's right.
And also the process of acquiring or understanding the Islamic economy.
That's
this
right.
process is very yes, well very explained in that book.
Okay.
And he brings up with an idea of that he called nazariye tawzi' pish az tawlid.
That's right.
The idea of distribution before production.
Production, that's right.
And the other idea, which is the idea of distribution after production.
Yes.
He explains this. And also the production idea,
that's right.
The theory of production.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually he talks about responsibility of the Islamic state in Islamic economy.
That's right.
What should the state do about Islamic economy if they want to really follow the Islamics?
That's right.
So this was a very brief overview of the book. And as you mentioned, and it was mentioned by Sayyid too, we come to see two different important concepts which are compared with each other. He says one thing that we have is the science of economy.
That's right.
And he separates the science of economy and economic school, especially according to his idea.
Yes.
And he says that the science of economy is after finding the relationship between the economic phenomena in the society and also the relationship between economic factors and phenomena. While
the maktab.
Yes, maktab or school. Economic school gives a method, a just method, a method that is based on justice in order to set up a prosperous economic life for the people.
For the people.
So it's more talking about the methods. It's not about finding the, you know, objective reality.
That's
that
right.
is up to the science of science of economy.
Yes.
And he says economic school of Islam is different.
That's right.
It's more about the method, and as I said, it's what it wants to give us.
Thank you very much, Dr. Azadeh.
You're welcome.
Said Mohsen Naghvi, what seems interesting to me about Iqtisaduna by Shahid Muhammad Baqir Asad and this look that he had at the Islamic economics is that it gives the people and the Muslims a kind of specific lifestyle. I mean, this is very important. I mean, capitalism and communism in their own countries, they have affected the system of the living, the daily lives of the people with their banking system, with their economic system, the transactions, I mean, trading here and there, stock markets. But what seems it was in the mind of Shahid Muhammad Baqir Asad was giving the people a kind of new look at their lives and applying the Islamic rulings in the life to introduce them a pure Islamic lifestyle through Islamic economics. We can find ethics or akhlaq in that. We could find social justice or edalat ijtimai in that. And these are the beautiful concepts that the people in the 21st and 21st century are looking after. It seems a nice model for the people to follow, isn't it?
Well, we should not forget that Shahid Sadr was a jurist. Mm-hmm. And it is the duty of jurists to mm-hmm. apply the Islamic rules in the society.
Very good.
To make people follow the Islamic rulings. It is the duty of jurists. And what I can see in the, what we see in his works, even if we look at the our philosophy, his book, or the our economy, the book that he has wrote, Iqtisaduna, he tries to explain people that if you follow Islam truly, you will have an Islamic economic system. You do not need to bring a system from outside. Mm-hmm. It's already there. Mm-hmm. It's already been set. And everything is linked to each other. For example, you know the main difference? Yes. We are talking about his idea about the Islamic economy being the maktab and not a sciences. Why it is maktab? It is because it is linked to all the Islamic rulings that we have.
That's right.
All the Islamic sciences. For example, you know, if I want to define profit according to the conventional definition that we have, non-Islamic definition mm-hmm. that we have, and in that definition, if I have, for example, if I tell you, like, I have given, for example, $100 charity out of 1,000, mm-hmm. what would be my profit? You will say $900.
Okay.
Because you're minimizing the charity that I have given. Uh-huh. It's not under the profit. It's okay. Something I lost. Mm-hmm. I did it for the sake of mankind or humanity.
Okay.
Whereas in Islam, this $100 is converted to 1,000, for example, dollars in hereafter. Mm-hmm. So in Islamic concepts, they do not count it as a loss. Mm-hmm. It is counted as a profit.
As an investment.
As an investment.
Yeah.
Yes. It is an investment. It is okay. A profit for you. It's yeah. A win-win situation for yes. You in the Islamic sciences. Mm-hmm. So when you come to the Islamic sciences, when you okay. link ethics with the economy, when you link political sciences with the economy, mm-hmm. when you link the social sciences with the economy, yeah. These all together becomes the Islamic
economical system. They will get to the justice.
System. Yes.
They will get to justice. Ethics is observed over there. Okay, so what a very beautiful
said,
picture.
And what Shahid okay. said is wanted to basically tell is, look, Islam as a whole is a political system. Mm-hmm. Islam as a whole is an economic system. If you follow the economic system mm-hmm. of Islam, it means that you're following the Islam. So the best way is to follow Islam.
That's right.
And you're following everything. And that's why, you know, in his book, when he came, he came and he argued about the Marxism, about yes. the communism first, and then he criticized the capitalism.
Yes.
Especially that's happening. And then after that, he started to develop mm-hmm. the ideas about the Islamic economic system.
Yes.
So this is the main thing about
him.
He was also
concerned about the natural resources and the yes. distribution of these natural resources among the people, you know, based on justice. This is very important. This is what Dr. Azad also talked about the Tawzi or the distribution, you know. This distribution system has also been tackled by Shahid Sad, and also in the last two chapters of his book, he talks about the role that the states and the governments have in
have
these.
The role.
Yeah,
yes. That's true. Say, because in the West, yes. in the capital system, we see everything is for the investors.
That's right.
The old yeah. profit, everything is for the investors, and that's why we can see, like in the West, for example, 99% of people like they're protesting against one person.
Yes.
The Wall Street protest that we had. Mm. So, but in the yes. Islamic economic yes. system, we can see like everything should be distributed on yes. the equality basis.
Equality, yes.
And that's
not amassing the wealth.
No.
Okay.
No. Obviously, okay. everyone has the right to live. Everyone right. has a right. Obviously, everyone needs protection. Mm-hmm. Everyone should have the best economy.
Okay.
And that's what Islam is talking about. Yes. Obviously, you know, Islam came to free the slaves.
Yes.
It voided the system of slavery.
That's right.
When the Prophet came. Islam came to help poor people. Like, we have homes, we have zakah, these charities that we have. On top of that, we have mustahab charities.
Yes.
The favorable charities, we can say. All these things tells us that Islam is talking about a system in which we have justice.
That's all right.
And in order to follow that just system, you need to follow Islamic rulings.
And the money and the wealth and the possessions, the farms, the land, the natural resources are like the trust in our hands.
Yeah.
So we have to observe justice to that. And what a beautiful world will be achieved if what Shahid Saad said in his book is to be followed. Thank you very much, Said Mohsen Naghvi and Dr. Rezazadeh, for a nice elaboration regarding the book Iqtisaduna and also Islamic economics as a maktab, a school of thought, and not a science. It was very kind of you. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. Please visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam Radio, also our YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanah.
Hello, welcome to the light. Sophisticated scanning technology is revealing new secrets about Littlefoot. That's a well-preserved fossil of an early human forerunner dating back to nearly 3.7 million years ago.
Now, the importance of it is not only that it is the only complete skull of an Australopithecus from anywhere, but it is the only one with a complete skeleton as well. Furthermore, it is the oldest Australopithecus in southern Africa, dating to 3.67 million years ago. So it tells us a lot about our early ancestry. Now, we're not saying that Littlefoot represents a direct ancestor to modern humans, but certainly a relative, certainly a very close relative of our ancestors.
The fossil was found in South Africa in the 1990s. It's now being studied at a particle accelerator facility in Oxfordshire, Britain. The facility allows scientists to produce X-ray images of the fossil with extreme detail. They say the result has been fascinating.
The bone microstructure look amazing because we can really see the different tissues, the proportions, the thickness, and also the size of the different canals. So all of this make Littlefoot more like a living person.
So far, scientists have found that Littlefoot stood on her feet. They know she had gorilla-like features such as powerful hands, which enabled her to climb trees. But she also had different traits compared to the human species believed to have first appeared 300,000 years ago. A Nigerian artist has become famous for his skills in creating art from coconut shells. Nathaniel Hodonu uses the shells to make stunning artworks in different forms, including portraits and sculptures, as well as home accessories. He collects shells from local oil factories, which throw them away as waste. He began his work in 2006 after his art teacher gave him two coconuts as a present. Hodonu now teaches art lovers creative ways to transform waste coconut shells into beautiful handicraft.
Tourism in Oman took a nosedive during the COVID-19 pandemic, sadly, much like many places in the world. But one village managed to turn its fortunes around by transforming some ancient homes into hotels and touristic attractions. Nestled in the high mountains of Oman, the village of Misfat al-Ibrahim offers some of the most beautiful and serene natural areas for trail running and rock climbing. Now the village has repurposed ancient mud brick homes into boutique hotels. The beige-coloured homes with walls of handmade mud brick are elegant and simple, and the interior spaces are furnished with traditional wood and textiles.
Miss Vetelabriin attracts many tourists, so people and project owners in the village have planned on expanding touristic projects. You'll find heritage hotels, popular cafes and restaurants. We, as a company, decided to provide various adventure-related activities too.
The centuries-old homes were renovated for safety and comfort to combine old Omani life with modern amenities. The village is near what is called Oman's Grand Canyon and has somewhere around 800 residents. Many tourists have visited.